sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Esther Lutenberg, Jewish author, publisher, and mental health advocate addressing suicide prevention. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. I was remembering this past week, the week following the 4th of July, an experience I had many years ago. It was 1976, year of the American Bicentennial, but I was actually in Israel on a summer Ulpan program sponsored by the Los Angeles Bureau of Jewish Education. Well, and of course, you know, paid for by my parents. I was thrilled to be in Israel, of course, a 15-year-old kid on an adventure away from home for the very first time. Our program was based for the summer at a Kfar Noar, a youth village called Meir Shvea in the north of Israel near Zichron Yaakov. We were learning Hebrew and working in the fields. It was an extraordinary experience, but I was also a little bummed to be missing out on all the festivities at home for the 200th anniversary of the founding of America. They arranged for the American kids on Ulpan who wanted to watch the majestic tall ships parade and fireworks on the only television available at Shvea, a small black and white screen TV. We were watching that when something amazing happened. The other big news story in Israel that summer of 76, besides the American Bicentennial, was the hijacking of an Air France jet by Palestinian terrorists. They took it to Entebbe, Uganda. About 250 people were on board that flight from Tel Aviv. It stopped in Athens on the way to its final destination of Paris. Instead, in Athens, two Palestinian terrorists, joined by two German Revolutionary Cell terrorists, boarded the flight. Once it was aloft, they redirected it to Idi Amin's Uganda. The story played out for us in the daily news. The Israeli and other Jewish passengers were separated out by the terrorists, while the non-Jewish passengers were released. The terrorists wanted Israel to free Palestinian terrorists held for earlier atrocities, plus other Palestinian terrorists imprisoned in other countries for murders. They threatened to kill all the Jewish passengers if their demands were not met. Ugandan dictator Idi Amin supported the terrorists, including deploying his air force and army to assist them. The drama built as the terrorist deadline approached. What would happen in the heart of Africa to the Israelis and other Jews held at gunpoint at the Entebbe airport? That night, the 4th of July, 1976, as we watched the bicentennial broadcast on that little TV, we suddenly heard shouts and cheers coming from the homes of the Israelis in Meir Shvea. That was followed by singing and more shouting and more cheering. What was going on? We went out into the courtyard of our youth village and got word. Israeli commandos had secretly been flown all the way to Uganda, and in a stunning operation, they had freed the hostages and flown them back to Israel. The euphoria in Meir Shvea was obvious. The Israelis, including our counselors and group leaders, were by and large a pretty reserved group compared to the boisterous American teens, but not that night. It was a real celebration of this amazing rescue. The commander of the Sayeret Matkal group of soldiers who freed the hostages, Yonatan Netanyahu, had been killed in the operation. Three of the hostages had also been killed in the raid, but over 100 were freed and brought to safety. The pride the Israelis felt was overwhelming, but we American Jewish kids were almost as excited. What a remarkable combination of events, this fabulous rescue happening on the 200th anniversary of our own nation. There was something so Israeli about that Entebbe rescue. It looked impossible, it took incredible chutzpah, and it was only activated when it became clear that diplomatic efforts were not going to free those hostages. And the actual operation, the capture of the airport and the freeing of Jews from their Palestinian captors, took a grand total of 53 minutes. The euphoria among the Israelis in our little youth village and the surrounding area lasted for weeks, and it was contagious. To some degree, we absorbed that Israeli enthusiasm and joy at this miraculous rescue. I think it may have been at that point that I fully became a lover of Israel. The newspaper picture of the heroic young commandos who rescued the hostages reinforced that. They looked like teenagers, just a few years older than we were, nonchalantly standing around the Mercedes they had used to impersonate Idi Amin's auto. They all had that very serious Israeli look, in contrast to our easy, meaningless American smiles. They were cool, in a way we hadn't yet identified, I don't think. I have been back in Israel so many times since that summer, lived there for a year. I've experienced Israel when things were terrible, in the middle of the Second Intifada, for example, and when things were great, like in the midst of the Oslo process, or at times of incredible economic growth the last few years. But I have never again had the privilege of sharing in a moment of great national joy like the Entebbe rescue. I imagine the thrill at the victory of the Six-Day War must have been even more amazing. But 9 years after that, having lived through many other challenges, Israelis rejoice completely in a way I've frankly never seen here in America. But I hope to see someday, without the trauma of surviving a terrorist attack or a war. Anyway, that made me really love Israel so much more, as a Jew who shared the joy and relief, to at least some degree. A great memory, oddly connected still with the 4th of July, every year. This week marks another holiday we can't actually share in person, the French celebration of Bastille Day on the 14th of July, their national celebration. I've actually been in Paris for that. It's fun. France was the very first nation on earth to give Jews full civil rights. It's well worth remembering their national holiday every year for that reason alone. But Bastille Day also provides us with a wonderful excuse to play a comedy cut from one of our all-time favorite Jewish comedians, the late, great Alan Sherman. Here's a special tribute to France and Bastille Day itself, when the French overthrew the tyranny of King Louis XVI and entered the modern world. It's called You Went the Wrong Way, Old King Louis.
Louis XVI was the King of France in 1789. He was worse than Louis XV. He was worse than Louis XIV. He was worse than Louis XIII. He was the worst since Louis I. King Louis was living like a king, but the people were living rotten. So the people, they started an uprising, which they called the French Revolution. And of course, you remember their battle cry, which will never be forgotten. Went the wrong way, old King Louis. You made the population cry, 'cause all you did was sit and pet with Marie Antoinette in your place at Versailles. And now the country's gone kablooey, so we are giving you the air that ought to teach you not to spend all your time fooling round at the Folies Bergères. If you had been a nicer king, we wouldn't do a thing. But you were bad, you must admit. We're gonna take you and the queen down to the guillotine and shorten you a little bit. You came the wrong way, old King Louis, and now you ain't got far to go. Too bad you won't be here to see that great big Eiffel Tower or Brigitte Bardot. To you, King Louis, we say fooey. You disappointed all of France. But then what else could we expect from a king in silk stockings and pink satin pants? You filled your stomach with chop suey, and also crepe Suzette's and steak. And when they told your wife Marie that nobody had bread, she said, let them eat cake. We're gonna take you and the queen down to the guillotine. It's somewhere in the heart of town. And when that fella there is through with what he's gonna do, you'll have no place to wear your crown. You came the wrong way, old King Louis. Now we must put you on the shelf. That's why the people are revolting, 'cause Louis, you're pretty revolting yourself.
Never let it be said that Too Jewish doesn't provide the finest and sophisticated Jewish culture at all times and seasons. That was Alan Sherman's You Went the Wrong Way, Old King Louis. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest, Esther Lutenberg, will explore the painful, important issue of suicide, preventing it, and addressing mental health issues in a productive way. Find out how to do that when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property, in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times, but in these days of coronavirus tsoras, join us Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. with me leading them, and Saturday morning Shabbat services at 10 a.m. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson. We'll have our services with full music by virtual experience weekly for the time being. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom, which you can access by emailing us at beitsimchatucson.org. Our synagogue is at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla on the north side, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. We aren't in the mall, but on the south side in our own building. For now, we are a fully functioning virtual congregation on Zoom and Facebook. Email me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, Beitsimcha, to get more information. You can learn about Beit Simcha, come to services, sign up for our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, all taught through Zoom for now. And of course, come to services on Facebook by going to beitsimchatucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's beitsimchatucson.org or 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest growing Jewish synagogue in all of Southern Arizona, in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Esther Lutenberg is an expert on all things psychological, I would say. She has published 139 books, as well as a variety of aids, having worked in the mental health field and as a publisher in the mental health field for a very long time. And today we're talking about suicide. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning to you.
So the notion of suicide prevention is always kind of critical in our society, and particularly among Jews, unfortunately. In this period of the pandemic and the coronavirus and the lockdown, there was a big jump in suicides, I think 600% for a while. It kind of leveled off after that. But why do you think so much, why do you think there's been so much of an increase in suicides and attempted suicides in this period?
I think people who have a mental illness have a difficult time being all alone, not being able to do what they want to do. I think that's really tough for them.
Is it also sometimes being in close proximity to just a couple of people that sometimes triggers people, do you
think? Depends on the person. Some people feel better to have people around, and other people don't want people around.
I can think of people who are locked in with people they'd rather not be locked in
and
with.
And that wouldn't be a good thing.
Yeah, very difficult.
Right.
Maybe this is wrong, but my perception is that, I don't know if it's correct or not, that suicide levels in the Jewish community are fairly high. Would that be an accurate perception?
I really don't know. I think it is all over. I think it's in every religion. I think it's everywhere. And I think it's more than it's been.
The greatest tragedy for so many of us to even consider would be a suicide in the family. Do people feel that there's this kind of a stigma associated with it?
Not as much today as there used to be. When my son was struggling with a mental illness, and that was probably in 1980, no one talked about mental illness. It was a shanda. It was something you didn't talk about. Today, we drive and we see billboards that say bipolar, you know, call one.
Call this number.
Right. He did not and would not tell anybody and asked us not to tell anybody that he had a mental illness. And we did not tell anybody that he did until the day he died.
We will explore the whole question and of course, Mitchell's death when we come back on Two Jewish with Esther Lutenberg, exploring the whole issue of suicide prevention, the ideology of it, and the kind of ways in which we can address it when we come back in just a moment here on Two Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as subscribable podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We now welcome back our randomly occurring feature of Two Jewish, our Zen Judaism segment, Haikus for Jews, Kohans, or Koans of Wisdom. Today I am a man. Tomorrow I will return to the seventh grade. And, testing the warm milk on her wrist, she sighs softly, but her son is 40. That was Zen Judaism, Haikus for Jews, Two Kohans, Koans of Wisdom, here on Two Jewish. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, one of the fascinating things about the Jewish world is how extensive it is. And even though there are not that many Jews in the world, there have been incredible Jewish communities in very far-flung places. The area that I've always found just sort of fascinating is the whole Silk Route, the area of Western Asia, Central Asia, all the way to China, where there were Jewish communities all along the way in the Middle Ages and really back into antiquity. You have some stories about that.
The Silk Route was a very, very old trading route, and it was developed by a series of great empires, mostly of Turkic peoples, not Turkish, but Turkic.
Right.
which include the Mongols, the Seljuk Turks, the Ottoman Turks, etc., etc. Now, most of those people have their origins somewhere in northeastern Asia, somewhere around Lake Baikal or Irkutsk or Mongolia today.
All places that we would know if we ever played the game Risk, by
right,
the way.
Right. But this ancient trade route obviously had, from the mists of time, and nobody's quite sure how old the earliest Jewish communities there are, but there were Jewish merchants and trading houses and the ancient equivalent of banks all along the way.
Yeah, kind of like merchant traveler, merchant bankers. They needed to be able to change money. They needed someone to insure their trips. There were Jewish connections all along the way.
Right. And this basically stretched from Venice through Istanbul, across what today are the Stans, and at least as far as Xi'an, where the famous terracotta warriors are.
In China.
And that city, which is actually not even in Western China, it's kind of
central, yeah,
has a whole Muslim quarter, which feels and looks and smells more like the Middle East than like China. It feels like a very foreign encroachment into modern Chinese culture and architecture and everything else. So that's many thousands of miles. And there are dozens of Jewish communities worth talking about that have, in many cases, their own very distinctive traditions, whether culinary or musically or in terms of the liturgy. I mean, Bukhara Jews are very different from Samarkand Jews. And those two cities today are in the same country by chance, Uzbekistan. But that wasn't always the case because empires shifted borders right and left all through, I would say, easily a period of 1,500 years.
It's a fascinating part of the world. And why don't we explore some of that when we come back next week. Thanks so much, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Moshe Cohen is 82 years old and he makes an appointment with a doctor very well known for his work curing impotence. The doctor examines Moshe carefully and says to him, "Mr. Cohen, I've examined every part of you. I can honestly say you're in excellent condition for a man of your age, so tell me, why are you really here?" Moshe says, "My friend Bernie tells me he makes love to his wife 3 times a day, and I can't do that, doctor." The doctor smiles and says, "Yes, you can. You can also say you make love to your wife 3 or 4 times a day." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and, you know, say what you want. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portions of Matot and Maaseh, the last sections of the book of Numbers, Bamidbar. Both portions teach an important message about the centrality of Jewish family values, but they do so in very different ways. The setting for these final parshiot in Numbers is the border of the Promised Land as the Israelites approach Canaan for a second time after their 40-year sojourn in the wilderness of Sinai. As the tribes gather to enter the land, two of them, Reuben and Gad, make a strange request of Moses. "We like the land we're traveling through here, on the east bank of the Jordan, in what is today the nation of Jordan, long before the Arab peoples moved to the Middle East." The leaders of the tribes of Reuben and Gad say, "Let us stay here and build sheepfolds for our flocks and towns for our children." Moses agrees, but in interestingly changed language. First, he tells them, "Build towns for your children, then build sheepfolds for your flocks." The message here is clear. Families come first, professions and income second. It's a human message and one that we need to relearn in every generation and some of us multiple times. Put family first. Then, in the very last section of Numbers, Maaseh, an important and unusual institution is created, the city of refuge. In the days before police forces and criminal courts were common, justice in cases of manslaughter or murder was accomplished by the family of the victim. Vigilante action was the normal means to address the moral and social disruption created by killing. If you killed someone intentionally or accidentally, or even if the family of the person who was killed thought you committed the killing, you would likely be killed by their kinsmen. Which meant that if you were involved in a terrible situation like that, you had very little chance to stay alive, even if the killing was accidental, even if you were totally innocent. The wheels of justice might turn for you eventually, but if you were already dead in revenge killing, it wouldn't help. This kind of reprisal killing also could and did lead to cycles of violence and revenge, the sort of blood feuds Mark Twain described about the Hatfields and the McCoys several millennia later, the kind of clan murder revenge cycles that take place even today in the Palestinian Arab towns of the West Bank and Gaza. To preclude this social disaster, the Torah portion of Maaseh provides for six cities of refuge in and around Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel. No person entering these cities may be executed without a fair trial. Being present in a city of refuge is a kind of protection, the guarantee of due process that has become central in modern law but was mostly absent throughout human history. Yet the Torah established that principle some 3,000 years ago. Whether it did so to protect innocents accused of murder or simply to keep families from falling into cycles of revenge, we don't know. But we do know the Torah teaches us in this unique way that the most basic unit of society must be nurtured, maintained, and protected, and its positive values strengthened, even in the most trying of all situations. A great message still. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, author and publisher Esther Lutenberg, will explore the issue of suicide and suicide prevention from a very personal perspective. Don't miss this important topic when we return on To Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Prominent sports figures got involved in an anti-Semitic speech controversy last week. Philadelphia Eagles wide receiver DeSean Jackson said he has no hatred towards the Jewish community. He issued two separate statements of apology with a promise to do better after he posted an anti-Semitic message on social media that he attributed to Adolf Hitler and added admiration for Nation of Islam leader, the anti-Semite Louis Farrakhan. The Eagles responded by calling Jackson's post offensive, harmful, and absolutely appalling, said the team would take appropriate action. Eagles team owner Jeffrey Lurie and general manager Howie Roseman are both Jewish. Jackson spoke with Lurie. Lurie expressed deep disappointment. Jackson expressed a desire to educate himself and work directly with the Jewish community, and shortly afterwards, his camp contacted the rabbi at Chabad Young Philly to discuss ways for DeSean Jackson to donate and work with the organization. The controversy spun out of Jackson's Instagram story. He featured a quote he attributed to Hitler that said, "White Jews will blackmail America. They will extort America. Their plan for world domination won't work if Negroes know who they are." He also shared two posts on Instagram expressing admiration for Farrakhan, whom the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center have both identified as virulently anti-Semitic. Those posts have since been deleted, of course. "We have spoken with DeSean about his social media posts," the Eagles said. "Regardless of his intentions, the messages he shared were offensive, harmful, and absolutely appalling. They have no place in our society and are not condoned or supported in any way by the organization. We are disappointed. We reiterated to DeSean the importance of not only apologizing, but also using his platform to take action to promote unity, equality, and respect. We continue to evaluate the circumstances and will take appropriate action. We take these matters very seriously, are committed to continuing to have productive and meaningful conversations with DeSean, as well as all of our players and staff in order to educate, learn, and grow." In response, New England Patriots receiver Julian Edelman, a star himself, invited DeSean Jackson to visit the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. In a video posted on Instagram, Edelman suggested that the black and Jewish community should try to uplift and enlighten each other. I think the black and Jewish communities have a lot of similarities. One unfortunate similarity is that they are both attacked by the ignorant and the hateful, said Edelman, wearing a Star of David necklace in the video. It's really hard to see the challenges a community can face when you're not part of it. So what we need to do is we need to listen, we need to learn, we need to act. We need to have those uncomfortable conversations if we're going to have real change. Julian Edelman, who also revealed an anti-Jewish slur was used against him on the field in the NFL in 2011, indicated his only communication with DeSean Jackson in the past has been over social media, but he wants to change that, and at the same time begin working on the real change he feels both are seeking. Former NBA player Steven Jackson made even more anti-Semitic remarks while defending DeSean Jackson, who is no relation. In an exchange last week with another Instagram Live user, Steven Jackson said, "The Jews are the richest. You know who the Rothschilds are? They control all the banks. They own all the banks." Asked if he thought Jews were trying to divide the black community, Jackson replied, "No, but I don't think they stand up for us as much as they should." The claim about the Rothschilds, which has for centuries been the focus of anti-Semitic vitriol and conspiracy theories, came as Steven Jackson affirmed his love for Louis Farrakhan, the anti-Semite leader of the Nation of Islam. Farrakhan has made numerous viciously anti-Semitic claims over the years, including about the Rothschilds. In a speech just last year, Farrakhan said he was here to separate the good Jews from the satanic Jews. Steven Jackson was a good friend of George Floyd in Houston, murdered by Minneapolis police in an incident that catalyzed the protest movement nationally. Since that terrible event, Steven Jackson has become a prominent voice against police brutality and racial injustice. "I didn't ask for this position," Steven Jackson said last month. "God just put me here." Well, I don't think God put him there to advocate anti-Semitic themes. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world.
Our brothers, lost of Israel.
We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Esther Lutenberg has worked in the mental health profession for, oh boy, a long time, as a mental health counselor, as a publisher. You have written 139 books. Is that a record?
I don't know. It's my record. I'm going to correct you on something. I was never a mental health therapist. During the 8 years that my son was attempting to die by suicide, and he tried four times, he succeeded the fourth time, I went to, and he only confided in my husband and myself and no one else. He would not let us tell our three daughters that he had a mental illness. During that time, I went to every psychologist, psychiatrist, mental health therapist, everyone I could go to. I took every class I could take at a college level to learn more about mental health, because it was all on us. He wouldn't talk to anybody about it. So I'm not an official therapist. I like to think I help some people, but I was his therapist for a long time.
When you started to develop the materials that you've used and have been helpful to many people in addressing the danger of, as you put it, death by suicide, where did you go and how did you develop those?
Well, I was lucky enough to have a daughter. I still have her, my daughter, Kathy Kalsa. And Kathy was a an occupational mental health therapist who worked with mental health. She found that she needed some pages that were easy for someone to use. It's very, very difficult for people to talk about their feelings about mental health, especially in those years. And she felt that if we had a piece of paper and it looked like fun to fill out, people would be more inclined, because they're not having to say it, so they would fill it out. And then a good therapist would take that piece of paper and say, I see where you wrote this. What did you mean by that? and it would get them talking. So she felt she wanted to write a book with reproducible activity handouts. And because we were not interested in making money, we were only interested in helping people, we made them reproducible. So no one, a hospital only had to buy one. And you just...
You bought one copy, and then you could use it for a group of people.
Exactly.
Or however many people you needed.
And every one of my books are reproducible handouts. So someone only has to buy one. And so Kathy came to me, and my husband and I were in the graphic arts business. And she said to me, you know, you now have your PhD in psychology. I said, not really. She says, yeah, you do. Because for 8 years, that's all I did was try to keep Mitchell alive. And so she said to me, would you write a book with me? And I said, yeah, I guess so. So we did. We sat down and we wrote Life Management Skills. It was 50 handouts for people to fill out. Within 2 months of it being out, people were asking when Life Management Skills 2 came out. So within, I don't remember how many years, I guess maybe 8-10 years, we had 8 life management skills books. We had other books for teens, and people were coming to us if we would publish their books. So we had about 30 books. I was running our business because Kathy was still working at the hospital. And I was running Jay's business, so I'm running 2 businesses and 17 employees. And I said to Kathy one day, oh my God, I just can't do it all. She says, sell the business. So we did. We sold it to a New York firm called Guidance Channel. And they carried our books, and we carried their books. We had a 64-page catalog. And we sold it to them. They flew us, Kathy and I, into New York for 5 years, once a month. Picked us up with a limo. Pretty
nice.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Really nice.
Nice setup.
Uh-huh. And we helped them talk about, we found out what was selling, what wasn't, and we continued to write books. They sold it to another company, and the other company... sold it to another company, and we were soon not writing books. Kathy was okay with that. She was done writing books, though I have connived her into writing a book right now. And I really wanted to continue writing. So I emailed all of the people who had ever written a book for our company and said, would you be willing to co-write a book with me? Because I don't feel that I should write a book alone, because if I were a mental health therapist, I would want to see those initials in the front of the book of being a mental health therapist. And many of them said yes, and I'm still writing with them.
It's an amazing story. I want to come back to the question of suicide and suicide prevention. You know, some of it's just linguistics. The typical phrase you hear on the phrase is somebody tried to commit suicide, or they committed suicide. You don't use that phrase.
No,
tell us why.
Well, that sounds like when you say committed, it's like you committed a crime. They are not committing a crime. They're doing what they feel they have to do to gain peace.
To end their pain?
To end their pain. They are suffering terribly, and they just feel that's what they need to do.
I want to bring you back to, I know, an utterly painful subject, but one that you've, I think, unearthed in really powerful ways, which is Mitchell's own death, your son's death.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a letter before he died. Can you tell us about that and then maybe read a little bit of that?
I'd be glad to. We had Mitchell's business and our business were in the same building. And Mitchell walked by my office and saw me crying, and he asked what was wrong. And I told him that a good friend of ours who lived in California just called that their son had died by suicide. And I was crying. And Mitchell knew why I was crying because he had already tried to die by suicide, I think, two or three times. And he excused himself. He went into his office, and within 10 minutes, he came back with a letter to write that he wrote to this young man's parents, our friends.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like me to read it?
Yes, I would.
He wrote, "It is with a great deal of regret and sympathy that I write this letter. There is no way that a death can be made acceptable, least of all one of your children. My father once told me that it was my job to be at his funeral, not his to be at mine. While that statement makes some degree of sense, it is never an absolute. Many things change the scenario. Your son did the only thing that made sense to him, as illogical as that sounds. In an act of desperation and thoughts, he chose not to live. The pain he was experiencing was more than he chose to continue with. Had he been physically ill with a cancer or something of that variety, this death might have made more sense. But you will have to accept his decision. You have no choice. While I may not be as religious as some, our religion very clearly specifies the method, length, duration of our mourning. There is no difference in whether it's a parent or child. The mourning will still go on. The grief you now feel is well placed, as we are mourning for you here in Cleveland. Many wise people have made more of a life in death than there was. It was not your son's intent to become a martyr, but to end the state of discomfort and pain that he felt. I suggest to you that you consider his belief that this was his last chance at peace or sanity. One's mental health is more valuable than physical well-being, and without being peace, little is worth it. Whatever the problem was, your son is now at peace. His decision was made knowing the pain you would feel, but overriding that concern was his own pain. I do not profess to know all of it, but ask that you accept his decision as he intended, and within Jewish doctrines, you and all of us will mourn his death, but we will continue. As I said before, I regret writing this letter and absolutely would prefer not having done so." And then he ended it just saying, "If you wish to talk, I am available." And he gave his phone numbers.
Mitchell died by suicide like 9 months later, right?
Yes.
When someone asks you what to say to a friend, a relative who is contemplating dying by suicide, what do you tell them?
I tell them that that person really needs to talk about it. Fortunately, we are in a day and age where we do talk about it more, so it's not like you're asking them the impossible. Asking Mitchell was asking him the impossible to talk about it. We're many years later. They need to go to a therapist. They need to talk about it. They need not to be ashamed of it. There is a stigma around mental illness. And we need to stop using the words nuts and loony and crazy. We need to use the words mental illness. And it's really convincing them to stick with the therapy, to talk to people about it, not to be embarrassed by it. You have good friends, tell them what you're going through. Tell them that if you seem grouchy one day, it's nothing against that person. It's just they're having a bad time. So it's really opening up.
When families have struggles with the ability to admit that there's mental illness in the family, what do you tell them?
I tell them that there's no difference between a mental illness or a physical illness, and there is no difference. It's one is of the mind and one is of the body, period.
Do you, this is a tricky question, I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you feel like in some ways so much of your work has been motivated by Mitchell's death?
It's only been motivated by Mitchell's death. I just want to help other people. and I want to help the therapist. It's not easy. And by giving, you know, it's hard to for people to talk, forgive me for saying this, especially men. It's really hard to talk about feelings and what's going on. And I really believe, and I think it's so, that these books, by writing things down and having somebody discuss it with them, I think it makes all the difference in the world.
I want to highlight one more point, which is you noted that there's a lot of games and bingo and stuff.
Yes,
so talk about that a little bit,
well,
would you?
Okay. When we started writing, we did a deck of cards that went with each of the books. So each card represents a page in the book. So a therapist might pull out a card that she wants to discuss that day and ask the question on the card. And then everybody answers, and then she pulls out that piece of paper, hands it to everybody to fill in. So we did cards. If I've done 139 or whatever it is books, there's 139 decks of cards. Many of them have bingo games. So within the square, it asks questions that you have to answer. And then we did some board games. The Bridge of Self-Confidence, I remember that's one. And one is Life Skills. Kathy would probably remember the others.
Life Skills, and, you know.
It's all about life skills, really.
It really is. And it's a way of access, of getting people to access it and moving past their nervousness, their concerns,
exactly,
their stigma, all of the things that people can feel about mental illness.
Exactly.
And relaxing them until they can open up and talk and share.
Right.
Where can people go to find out more about getting these books and
just
particularly
go
about
online
how?
And put in Esther Lutenberg.
Lutenberg. She pops up all over the place.
Right. And it's on Amazon and it's on the individual. I'm right now writing for five publishers. One is in England and four of them. One's with the military.
A serious problem with suicide, I might add.
Very much so, and we just did five books for them. So it's there. It's out there.
Esther, thank you so much.
Thank you for being interested in the subject and wanting to help.
It's so important. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. I hope that you guys had the opportunity to watch the video of the great Broadway show Hamilton, just released on Disney Channel for the 4th of July. Our playout this morning comes from cantor Ozzie Schwartz of Park Avenue Synagogue, singing Oseh Shalom and Adon Olam to the tune of You'll Be Back from Hamilton. Silly, but great fun. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Professor Shuli Rubin Schwartz, the new chancellor of Jewish Theological Seminary, the very first woman to hold that post as titular head of the conservative movement. My friends, may you have a healthy week, God willing, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Oh, say, shalom bimromav, hu yaseh shalom aleinu. Oh, say, shalom bimromav, hu yaseh shalom aleinu. Ve'al kol, al kol Yisrael, ve'al kol yoshvei tevel, ve'imru amen. Al kol Yisrael, ve'imru amen. Adon Olam, asher malach, terem kol yetzir yetzir nivra, let nasa, v'cheftzo kol, azay melech shemo nikra, ve'acharei, kichlot hakol, levado imloch imloch nora, ve'hu aya, ve'hu ove, ve'hu yi. fara adon olam asher malach da 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 Terem kol yetzir yetzir nifra Let nasa b'chepzo kol Azai melech shemo nikra Beyado afkid rochi Betishan v'aira Ve'il rochi gebiati Adonai li velo Velo La 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 everybody la 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 שהוא ספרי ברוך אתה אדוני אלוהינו מלך העולם אדון עולם אשר מלך בטרם כל יציר יציר נברא לתנסה וחפצו כל אזי מלך שמו נקרא ואחרי ככלות הכל לבדו אם לא כמלוך נורא והוא היה, והוא הווה, והוא יהיה, יהיה בתפארה, אדון עולם אשר מלך, דה 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 בטרם כל יציר יציר נברא לתנסה בחפצו כל אזי מלך שמו נקרא בידו הפקיד רוחי בתישן ואירה ועם רוחי גביעתי אדוני לי ולא ולא La 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 everybody la 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 Shabbat by Kadeshehu Safri Baruch Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam Bore Periagafe.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.